Hello, everyone, and welcome to the AI in Business podcast. I'm Matthew DeMello, Senior Editor here at Emerge Technology Research. Today's guest is Daniel Ferranta, AI leader in R&D and data strategy at Deloitte. Together with Emerge CEO and Head of Research Daniel Fajella, they delve into the complex challenges in AI adoption that major pharmaceutical firms encounter with cultural shifts, technological complexities, and the difficulties in monetizing data and aligning teams efficiently. Additionally, the pair explores the future landscape of phenotypical drug discovery, drawing insights from the context of COVID-19. Their focus underscores the critical importance of collecting and analyzing data to yield actionable insights, especially in the healthcare sector and amidst global health crises. Without further ado, here's their conversation.
All right, Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I'm happy to be here today.
Absolutely. And we're going to be diving in on the world of drug discovery and probably some adjacent processes as well. Lots of action going on here. Since COVID, huge amounts of attention in terms of AI investment in discovery, speeding up that costly and lengthy process of bringing something new to market. When you're out there talking to the biggest pharmas in the world, when you're out there talking to scientists and people doing the work, what are the trends and challenges that are making AI a relevant part of the discourse today?
So I think it's a great way that you divided it that way, because we see a little bit of a bimodal distribution, meaning that the bigger players have a certain set of challenges, because for them to move all the drug discovery, all the R&D processes and whatnot, it's a very different beast than for the smaller biotech folks that have the need to squeeze all the information from however much data they may have, right? So roughly speaking, typically the bigger players will have a huge amount of data, while the smaller guys are either trying to generate their data or trying to buy their data and whatnot. So the challenges are a little bit split in some sense. On the smaller end of the spectrum, if you will, but and those are all relative measures, but on the smaller end of the spectrum, right? We see these folks that are maybe born on the cloud, born with AI in mind, or they're much faster to adopt a new technology here, or try a new thing here, a new model that comes up. They can just start playing around and be a little bit more agile and flexible in that way. So those folks, typically there, the challenge is not so much like a technology type challenge necessarily, but it will be maybe more towards talent. But having these teams that do AI for drug discovery typically will require not only the guy that does the AI, but also the data engineer, so the data scientist, the data engineer, if you will, the actual scientist, the biologist or what have you, the chemist that will be sitting on the drug discovery side. So you typically end up with a team of 5-6 folks, and let's say just half a dozen folks that have to work together. Right? And these spokes in the wheel, more often than not, their challenges are systemic rather than individuals. So it's not that the team doesn't work well with each other. It's just that if they need the data and the data engineer can't bring the data, then he'll have friction or, you know, attrition with the biologist or the chemist or with the data scientist that wants to make a model, but and so on and so forth. And then I don't mean to pick on the data availability side. That's true around that circle kind of thing, right? So making those happen fast so those teams can be effective is one side. One other side that we see a little bit still inside this spectrum, particularly say for smaller companies that typically tend to be the ones that attack rare diseases or harder drug discovery modalities, like say, you know, through oligos or RNA or what have you, those folks tend to have teams that are super sharp on the biology side, for lack of a better term. Like those are sharp scientists, but they might not necessarily have either the AI background or the technology background. So they're set into doing the things that they've been doing for a while. And this is not good or bad, but it's a little bit of a mind change to trust that the machine can be given.
Exactly, yeah.
On the bigger end of the spectrum, for the top 5-10 pharma companies, give or take, right, those folks tend to have a little bit more of an ID challenge, just because I joke and say that this is a geological problem. So just like Earth has a bunch of layers, these guys have layers because they've been around for 50, 100, 150 years. The data's been created this way, the other way, blah, blah, blah. Like you have all of these
strata. Yeah, these strata.
That's right. That's exactly right. Right. Across it. And then having to adjust this to now make this, the plumbing available for you to do AI on the other end. is a huge cultural shift, is a huge technology shift, is a huge lift on several different corners. Not to mention that in their case, you know, typically they might have easier access to talent in the sense that they can buy acquire talent much faster, much more easily and whatnot. But on the other hand, they will typically have more friction, because if you need to get folks to move 2-3 different data modalities to one single point for these folks to work on this disease or whatever, it's much, much harder.
Yeah.
Because you have half a dozen different teams that can kind of do the same thing, but they kind of do it in their way. So sometimes the machines are not even, like, quite literally calibrated to the same gauge. For whatever reason, this is not judgment of it.
Yeah. Old companies, big companies, it's tough.
That's right. So you have the harmonization of this data or just the plumbing, for lack of a better term, necessary to bring it to bear and use on the other side, tends to be a little bit more on the challenging side.
Got it. So different sorts of hurdles for the more nimble digital first crowd and for the gigantic folks that have been around forever. When you think about, I guess, they have different hurdles that they go over, but they're all operating in the same industry with some of the same maybe industry trends or pressures. Talk a little bit about what's making AI more top of their mind now in terms of kind of a must-have to deploy. I mean, we see sort of COVID adding this pressure to kind of speed up what we're doing and seeing the wins from that and now knowing that that's possible. Maybe that's the new normal. We got to speed up. What else are you seeing that's shifting mindsets to tilt people more in this ML direction here?
But, you know, it's funny, not funny that you mentioned COVID per se, but it's funny because during COVID, one of the huge components for FDA approval was actually like the 3D structure and shape of the elements in the drug, be it the proteins, the small molecules, or how they combine with the spike protein and what have you. But that is something that the FDA didn't used to do just a few years back. Maybe, let's say, 7 to 10 years ago, that wasn't part of the submission at all. And the reason why I'm saying it this way is because I believe we're on a similar path with AI, meaning that there's a lot that we can do with different types of model, different applications of AI at different portions of the drug discovery value chain. And I believe sooner or later, just like it happened with structures before, the FDA will start requiring some of these tests, if you will, going forward, right? Just because you want to narrow the gap of side effects or undesired, you know, correlations across your data, because that might lead to some third effect somewhere else. And, like, being able to show that these things are true, either on the clinical side or on the early R&D side, you know, might become relevant, particularly for patent IP applications.
Yeah, so the regulatory kind of pressures and environment might sort of force us to level up our skills in order to keep up with them.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So that's a forcing factor. Anything else for you that's relevant there too?
I think that the sheer power of the technology to help unlock the science. But so I joke sometimes that we use AI as a tool, but we're really doing science. So I joke and say science as AI, right? Because yes, we're doing a lot of AI, but the goal is how can we crack this nut faster and more effective, right? So if you sit today with anybody on the earlier side of R&D, these folks will have typically, you know, whatever, half a dozen different tabs open on different databases that are there either for structures like UniProt or Campbell for small molecules or this or that. So they pick a number here, they pick a toxicity there, they pick a shape here, blah, 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 like an amino acid sequence, and they're trying to understand their process. Like, what if you could not only bring and unify different databases to give to people, but then put that information in different models in effective ways that when then combined with the private data that these companies have, which in many ways is comparable to the amount of data that the scientific, the academic already has, can make them that much more effective. Particularly if we're talking Gen AI or LLMs, like just the sheer amount of data that these models require is having that background that comes from the open source, open science, or whichever way we're going to call that, the academic world to bear. And then putting your private data on top of it to get those sharpened vices across the direction that you're looking at, I think that's potentially super powerful.
Yeah, okay. And this is kind of leading us into where we're headed already, which is the use case side, where this stuff really adds value. To your point, the capabilities have made some significant leaps and bounds. I mean, we've been following this pharma AI space for 7 years or so ourselves. I remember the first wave and very, very different place now with Gen AI, with how much attention is on this, with what the technology is capable of doing. Talk to us a little bit about some of the areas of the drug discovery process where you really see the most leverage in the near term for those professionals, for really making a difference in workflow. You can cover as many of them as you want, but let's walk through some of these areas of impact for you.
So let's maybe frame it in terms of different types of drug discovery, if you will, right? And I'll crack that open with, for example, AlphaFold and structural drug discovery. So this connects a little bit of the comment that we did before about FDA approval, IP submission, and whatnot. And it's one modality of drug discovery where the sheer fact that AlphaFold exists a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago, give or take, was a huge changing factor. It was completely, I would have said, a phase, first order phase transition. Like, it didn't exist before, now it exists. It was completely, it wasn't something gradual. It completely changed the landscape of that modality, because now you can figure out shapes that you couldn't before. And what I mean by that is, imagine we're back at, you know, February, March, give or take, 2020, COVID is coming up. Nobody knew the shape of human COVID that was still being searched, studied. And if you could have had a faster start with that, how much better could you have done? Now, obviously, the pandemic is a particular example that I'm picking out of the blue, but the same is true for everything else. And I understand that, you know, somebody might say, oh, look, AlphaFold DeepMind already done all the proteins known to humankind on databases, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I'm sure they did. But how these things, how do you use this in a scientific fashion? It's a different kind of question. So I like to think of it as this is one or two box, and you should be combining probably many more to answer scientific questions. So AlphaFold folding things is great and did change the perspective, and it is revolutionary. But the real question is, how do you use it effectively for your pipeline or for a discovery pipeline, right? So the question for those guys, I say they're doing biologics, proteins or antibodies or what have you. And there will be specific places in those proteins or antibodies that are your secret sauce. So what you really, really want to do is optimize those special links or spots or what have you to make sure that you get the 3D structure and the function that you're looking for. So now you're putting together two or three different models to frame that question that way. I'm sure AlphaFold, ESM2, or what have you, the whole zoo that comes out of that, they're all part of this process. But really, putting it together is an exercise that every company, every individual, if you will have to do for themselves, for the challenge that they have in front of them. And this is one modality, right? If you're talking in terms of phenotypical drug discovery, then you have to create this link between clinical trials, if you will, clinical observations, doctor's observations, and what have you, all the way back to early R&D. And this is a huge feedback loop in the drug discovery value chain that for you to separate every spurious correlation or variable that may or may not have added an effect or adjusted the results or whatnot is a miserable process, like folks typically will know and understand, right? And I think there's a lot of room to use AI to do all sorts of things, from cleaning the data all the way up to actually stratifying the different branches of correlation that you may find, so that you can put this in a landscape or a picture that makes sense, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, if we could. This idea of would you say phenotypical? Repeat the term real quick.
Phenotypical drug discovery.
Got it. Yeah. So in this case of phenotypical drug discovery, walk us through sort of what that is in practice, maybe with an example of a real or kind of example drug or condition, and then I'm going to kind of pick apart the making sense of those correlations and the cleaning of the data and some of these things you said. We're going to go into those a little bit, but talk to us about what this looks like in practice, phenotypical drug discovery.
And you can even do, I mean, this might be a little overloaded of an example, but we can even do it sort of in parallel with COVID. Right in the beginning of COVID, for example, we didn't know that if we wore masks or that COVID was transmitted by the air, right? That if everybody just put masks, you know, we could have addressed things slightly different than we necessarily did or what have. Could you have figured that out sooner or later? Everybody took that in an analogy with the flu, with respiratory diseases of some capacity. That was the only, not the only, but like that was the primary MO at that moment.
Yep.
I don't know if we knew enough, if we had any information that could have changed things in the beginning. But for example, there was a lot of studies of COVID in animals. Right. And this jumping of diseases from animals to humans and from humans to animals is actually a lot more prevalent than people talk about. public or in polite conversation, but the data does exist.
Okay.
And it is a study. So just being able to collect it all, create something, let's say a data package that you can be actionable with, is super powerful. So in an analogy, for example, with techniques that you do for money laundering in fintech, right? So it's not just about doing the statistics of the data, but it's about stratifying data in a particularly actionable fashion. And the way you typically do that is by using networks. So graphs, mathematically speaking, networks, as in my behavior of using my credit card is similar to your behavior, or we have the same demographic, or we have this, or we are certain age. Those are all different cuts of the data. So this different stratification of the data, you create a graph over that. So where we belong to different communities. Communities of people that always do this, always do that, boom, boom. And that collection of communities, if you will, makes me unique, makes you unique, right? So if I use my credit card somewhere else, oh, you don't belong to that community. So now I can tell you're doing something weird. Something similar can work here, meaning that we can extract all this data that might exist across the spectrum of all that has been studied before and published and whatnot, and then slice it according to ways that are more effective to us. Creating a knowledge graph like this is super powerful, and potentially have AI manage something like this adds that extra sweet cream on top of it.
Yeah. We'll talk about the management of it and the cleaning of the data as well. But do you foresee this dynamic of sort of having these giant structures and kind of defined clusters? Because you use the fraud analogy. We've talked to all the AI research folks at the companies doing this stuff. I imagine they don't all have exactly the same demographic of, okay, this age, right? They cluster differently, but they're still meaningful. Do you see the same thing happening in life sciences? In other words, do you see these being very proprietary in the future as AI becomes more prevalent here?
That is a fantastic question. And I'm going to answer it probably in a little convoluted way, but I'll answer it because that's sort of the inspiration that we had in the beginning.
Let's do it.
So what I did for my PhD was roughly studying the solution space of certain equations. What that means is, like, sometimes you have an equation, like we all have AX squared plus BX plus C or what have you. And the real question there is, so what does it mean to solve the equation? So it's not exactly what we might have done in high school, but it's like you have, I'll say, three variables. It's not exactly how people talk about it, but you have three variables, A, B, and C, three parameters, I should say. X is your variable, three parameters. Now, if A is zero, you have a linear equation. You don't need to worry about it. So you can divide everybody by A. So now you learn something new. The space of parameters is not three-dimensional, it's two dimensions, because you can only divide by A now, because otherwise, you already knew the solution.
Sure.
So you go back. So now you don't think about it B over A or C over A, but let's just call it B and C to make life simple. So you have this two-dimensional space of solutions. Like, what does that mean for the equation? What are the corners where they exist, they don't, and what have you? Because remember, things could be complex, things could be real, they could be zero, your delta could be positive, negative, zero. The same is true for AI. And what I mean by that is, when you have a model, you have an input, you get an output, right? Nowadays, we speak about it as you have your graph, which is the whole TensorFlow graph type of thing from way back when. That's your model. You have your input, that's your data point, that's your, whichever way your data is being represented, that vector is your input data. Now you get your output, and the output, we nowadays call that an embedding. So it's a vector that now lives inside the AI space, inside the AI mind, if you will. Now, the caveat to that is, let's make this interesting and put a parameter in front of the input and in front of the output. So now we have model times A times input vector equals B times embedding vector, output vector. Now we can vary A and B. And the real question, or the typical question that somebody makes at this point, is why would you want to do that? So the reason I want to do that is the following. Say you do it, call A and B one, and that goes back to what we were before. So now you're sitting on the solution inside the AI mind, inside the solution space, and you're just sitting there.
Sure.
Now my question is, what does the landscape look like around you? Is this a stable solution? And does this not exist at all for whatever reason? Like before, the delta was negative, then you have to be complex. And there are complex neural networks out there. So how does this look like? And the reason I want to map this is because maybe that embedding is robust and maybe it's not. And that changes substantially what you think about your data. Because if your data is brittle around that point, means you shouldn't trust your data very much. So it says something about your statistics. But you're doing that sort of in a perverse way, if you will, by just playing with A and B, with these two parameters, as opposed to like having a ton of data come in. So the ton of data and ton of embeddings are rags. And rags will put you into these pockets. I'm not going to call them clusters just because we're talking AI, and I don't want people to think of this as clustering types of algorithms, but I'll call them these pockets, these regions, and sure, and you can be very effective then and whatnot. I don't think it's very interesting to just sit there. I think these are great techniques to speed things up, speed searches up, and to do all sorts of things. But if you want to understand what your AI model has learned, what your neural network tensor has actually embedded in its weights and whatnot, right? You want to probe the whole landscape. You want to see the whole valley, whatever, in front of you.
Yeah.
That, I think, is powerful. So to the point that you made before, people's IP, or the way I think about it, would be different pockets around this thing. And it would be collection of these such pockets, because you're going to have data of different types for different diseases. They may or may not overlap with other folks, but the distribution that you have, you know, I would like to believe would be singular to you, would define who you are. So I can, your company A, or big pharma A, or small biotech C, or what have you, because you have 2-3 of these pockets that uniquely identify you. And, you know, it's not anti-money laundering. Like, I'm not trying to uniquely identify you, but if you're doing that driving, is it helpful to sit on only the pockets you have and then try to make them bigger? Or is it helpful to look at other ones and try to create different connections in the AI space? Real quick, just to wrap it, assuming that these models are learning things that are meaningful. If they drive your car, if they talk to you, if you trust them to drive your car or to talk to you or to do this and that, like, why wouldn't you trust them to learn chemistry and learn the space of allowable chemical connections and what have toxic ADMET properties, USAR properties. In biologics, if you trust AlphaFold or ESM2 or what have you, why wouldn't you trust them to literally learn evolution?
Yeah.
Because they're capturing these proteins, they're capturing their 3D shape on some level. Evolution is being encoded on these folks. On these models, like, why not trust that the same way you trust it to drive you to do whatever else that we do on a daily basis now, and use that in a more weaponized version, if you will.
Yeah. So this is starting to give me a picture. I'm going to try to nutshell it, Dan, for the folks at home and make sure that I'm understanding. So it would seem to me like, again, looking at the entire valley of this giant corpus made up of all these pockets, to use your term, of data that we've collected, different kinds of people, different ways that things can sort of gather together. You know, a big pharma A, B, or C, probably because of their historic focus in different disease areas or their research domains or whatever, by looking at the valley, it might even open up, hey, where do we have unique strengths to address diseases that maybe other people can't? Where's the sustainable differentiation now that we can not just see it in a silo, but see it across? Is this the right way to think of it?
And now make it worse or better, depending on how you want to phrase glass half full or empty type of thing, which is, when we talk about this and one model, this is effectively one data modality. So things like what we just discussed were images. You could do the exact same exercise for genomics, the exact same exercise for proteomics, for this, for that, for all the different types of data that you have. And now what you really need to discuss are all of those different solution spaces brought together, because you live in this multimodal world. So when you say, oh, maybe I have unique sets of pockets and this and that, where are my strengths, weaknesses? Now you have to start intersecting with all of these solution spaces for these extra modalities. And that is really what your thing looks like. Right, which is super powerful, because once you start bringing in all the different modalities, this unique identifier or this pocket distribution becomes even sharper or better well-defined, if you will, better defined for different folks.
Yeah, and I guess that is the grand vision, is that the stuff wouldn't all be a bunch of dark corners. It would be a great view upon which we could, you know, stretch out and reach out for possible solutions with ease and kind of know where things are. But of course, we've got to get our way there. So final question for you, Dan. In terms of advice for the folks at home, you know, our listeners are the people who are actively interested in how can this affect me? What is the future of my department, my workflow? When you talk to drug discovery leaders, whether they're maybe on the big side or the small side, maybe you have different advice for either or, what would be some advice that you'd have for them to start to really work towards this vision, to start to see some of the value of this big leap of this technology? What is the adoption advice that you'd like to leave with people?
So I think there's piece of it, which I compare a little bit with this maker garage movement type of thing. Like, just play a little bit, be curious, because even if you are in a type of drug discovery modality that is, I don't want to say arcane or Byzantine, but like that's hard otherwise speaking.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a model for that. because people have been working with models for a very long time, trying to attack like DNA and RNA data for a very long time. Like these things can potentially be used in effective ways, even if you are in a darker corner, so to speak, or in a harder corner of the spectrum. On the other side, I would say, look, historically, it has not been the mandate of IT institutions or IT departments to develop or to deploy these kinds of tools. But more often than not, their job is different, sometimes security related, sometimes like distribution of hardware related or whatnot, making sure that daily operations are run. So there's going to be a little challenge. But what I would say is preparing your data or working with these folks that typically cater to your data to harmonize your data as much as possible before you start sort of playing with it is key. And the reason I say that is regardless of size, whether you're a big pharma or small biotech, the way the scientists or the way the early R&D folks will typically think about the data is not about the data points per se, but they're already sort of extracting metadata from it, if you will. Like you see a plot from the proteomic side or from a cryo-EM experiment and what that, like when they look at that, they're not thinking, oh, my structure is so much. They're thinking, oh, my mode of activation, the shape and it is, or my data, my proteins have this much weight, blah, blah. Like I already know steps downstream that I want to do. So being able to, one, be super robust and repeatable in gathering the data itself and reproducible in that sense is a must. So just getting that hygiene done is a step. And it's less common than maybe I would like it to be. The other one would be to aggregate this metadata in some capacity. And this is not necessarily data curation and annotation, but it's a process that your scientists are already doing. So just being able to capture that is huge because, you know, now we can, for example, if those become notes, now we can mine all of that and we can do all sorts of things with that, right? That literally couldn't have been done, what, 14 months ago, 16 months ago, right? It's like you don't really know, but having the harmonization, having that notion that there are things inside your scientist's head that are not necessarily like just being captured by the daily processes is a huge advantage.
Absolutely. Well, I think 5 years ago, we used to have to force the medicine down the enterprise leaders' throats of sort of data infrastructure being important. I think they kind of knew it, but they just wanted to solve the Band-Aid. What we've seen, Dan, is a lot of tilting in the direction of being open to thinking about AI strategy, thinking about really our data infra as a key part of building capabilities, not just one thing, but the whole future of the company. So you reiterating this, I think, is great. And hopefully our audience is more receptive to this idea than they ever have been before. So Dan, I appreciate you reinforcing the fundamentals. I know that that's all we have for time on this particular call, but it's been a pleasure having you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wrapping up today's episode, some points I think should have left our audience with some greater impression, but you get a nice little summary here in the outro of today's show. Daniel began his episode by distinguishing between the challenges faced by larger pharmaceutical firms and smaller biotechs in drug discovery. He noted friction among teams rather than technical expertise impedes progress in smaller organizations. Large pharmaceutical firms struggle with cultural shifts, technological transitions, data monetization, and team alignment in adopting AI. COVID-19 prompted an increased focus on AI in drug discovery, with the FDA demanding 3D structural data for approvals. AI holds promise in accelerating scientific discoveries, particularly in drug development. Integrating open source academic data with proprietary information can enhance drug development and accuracy. Techniques like AlphaFold revolutionize protein structure determination and drug development efficiency. Effective use of AlphaFold requires optimizing structure-function relationships. AI streamlines drug discovery by filtering out irrelevant correlations and variables. Phenotypical drug discovery, illustrated by COVID-19, underscores the need for actionable data analysis. Data stratification akin to fintech practices is crucial for actionable insights in drug discovery. Proprietary data structures like those in fraud detection may emerge in life sciences. Daniel ends the podcast noting four crucial factors for AI applications in drug discovery. First, understanding the solution space of equations. curiosity and exploration, especially in the less explored realms of drug discovery, robust data infrastructure, and finally capturing metadata and scientist notes enriches the data-driven decision-making that makes the leaps and bounds we're currently seeing in drug development possible. On behalf of Daniel Fajella, who you heard from earlier today, that's our CEO and head of research, as well as the rest of the team here at Emerge Technology Research, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time on the AI and Business Podcast.